Assalamualaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. This is AB Dawji, and of course, this is the big picture. Well, all I can say is that it's really great to be back. And thanks to Mustafa Darsot for standing in and doing an excellent job. Yes, that's right, I missed you all very much. Every single minute, every single day, while I was with a group of 44 in Bosnia and Croatia. Yes, my eyes were full of tears whenever I thought about you. As I was whitewater rafting on the Neretva River in Bosnia, or strolling along the beautiful gullies of the ancient island of Korčula in Croatia. Yes, folks, Croatia and Bosnia are absolutely amazing. I have visited many cities, many beautiful places like Kashmir with the town, or in the town of Srinagar with the Dal Lake and the surrounding mountains. But I think that Dubrovnik in Croatia is the most amazing place, really. Very, very beautiful. Just Google it, eh? Google it right now on your mobile. Dubrovnik. 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 Just Google it and see the pictures of this place. And then we were in Sarajevo in Bosnia, a city full of character and wonderful people. Wonderful people, all looking like Swedish and Norwegians. Green eyes, blonde hair, all pakka vetos and all. With names like Khadija, Mahmoud, Muhammad, Amina and Zuleika. What a buzzing place, eh, Sarajevo? Till way after midnight, and quite remarkably full of people from Arab countries, lots of Saudis there, all visiting, having maja. All of us felt quite at home in Sarajevo. And I mentioned to you whitewater rafting. Everyone went into the rubber dinghies, the rubber rafts, young and old, all wearing life jackets, and at the rapids screaming, Allah! All great fun, maja, as I said. But of course, Bosnia is also a place of great sadness, a place of tears. And I spoke about this many times before, but I will speak about it over and over again whenever I visit the place. A place of unspeakable atrocities and tragedy. A place soaked in the blood of innocence. As you know, there was a war there in the early 90s, and very briefly, the Serbs attacked the Bosnian Muslims. People ran for their lives. The town of Srebrenica was declared by the United Nations to be a safe area, a safe zone. The United Nations sent a small contingent of Dutch troops to secure the place. Thousands of Bosnian Muslims flocked, they fled to Srebrenica for safety. Almost, I heard, 40,000. Most were out in the open. Through steaming hot weather and winters of harsh snowstorms. It was hell. But more hell was to follow. The Serbs surrounded Srebrenica and put it under siege. People began dying from starvation. Then they came down, the Serbs came down from the surrounding hills into Srebrenica, and the Dutch troops just gave way. And then the horror began. Young men, young and old, were taken behind the huge building, a former battery factory, and systematically gunned them down, massacred them. The women were raped. Then the Serbs brought in buses, a whole fleet of buses, and told the women and children to get on because they will be leaving the place. And then they assured these people, the women and children, that their men, all boys, all who were over 12 years old, the boys and the men, so the boys were all, had to be all over 12 years, they had to remain behind And the Serbs assured these women who were leaving that their husbands and their sons would be safe. There were heartbreaking scenes. How do we know that? Because the Serbs video recorded everything. They videoed everything. And we saw these videos. And after the buses left, the killings began. I just can't forget one particular scene. Six young men were taken to the forest in a truck. They had to jump out of the back of the truck with their hands still tied behind their backs. And they were in filthy conditions. They were escorted by heavily armed Serbs carrying machine guns and taken into the bush where we saw this video, as I said. Then the video stopped because the battery of the camera went flat. So the execution had to wait while the cameraman went back into the town to get another battery. And then they proceeded into the bush. Then we heard gunfire. Four were killed and two of them had to drag the bodies into shallow graves. And then they were also shot. I will never forget this episode. And here's what happened. All those who were killed were buried in mass graves around Srebrenica. As the war was coming to an end, and the Serbs, of course, were losing, they realized that these graves would be discovered and they would be in very serious trouble. So they brought in bulldozers to dig up these mass graves. Can you imagine what happened? All the bodies, the body parts, bones, all got mixed up. Then these pieces of bodies were taken and reburied far away from Srebrenica in mass graves. Reburied far away, the Serbs were hoping that they won't be found. But these graves were slowly being discovered since that time. And the body parts, of course, can only be identified by a process known as DNA matching. Very complicated process. So laboratories were set up to do this. And as you know, each one of us, each person's DNA is different. So what happened is that a person, say a father who lost his son, would go to the UN laboratory and be tested, and his DNA would be recorded. Then he has to wait and wait and wait. All the body parts recovered from the mass graves are tested and the DNA recorded. Then suddenly, after waiting for a long time, the father is informed that the DNA of maybe just a bone fragment is matched with his DNA. It's the remains of his son. And so that body part is given to the father. Maybe just a leg bone. So funerals are taking place all the time, constantly. Families bearing body parts of their loved ones. It's a very, very sad story. And so from Sarajevo we drove about 2 hours through beautiful, lush countryside to Srebrenica. So peaceful, so serene. And then suddenly, we come into Srebrenica. The shock of seeing a hillside, beautiful hillside, green hillside, covered with white pillars, tombstones. It really took our breath away. There were 8,300 pillars. Just Google it, eh? Srebrenica, Srebrenica, Srebrenica. Or just put the words in your Google, massacre in Bosnia, and you will see exactly what we saw. And as we walked among the tombstones, we read the names. 84-year-old Usman Tajik, or 14-year-old Mustafa Cherik, and so on. It was so heart-wrenching. Many of us had tears in our eyes. And I'm telling you, I'm getting all choked up myself. How could this happen? After the Holocaust, the world was told, never again. Never again. But that was a hollow promise. We saw it happening again and again and again. The Rohingyas, the Uyghurs in China. and the terrible suffering of the Palestinians and of the people of Yemen, a human tragedy of undescribable proportions, death and destruction. That's Yemen happening right now. I wonder if the slogan "never again" excludes Muslims. You know, I can speak so much about Bosnia, but let's leave it there and move on to another topic. Hajj. Hajj. What great joy, what great blessing. Alhamdulillah, for those who are embarking on this wonderful journey to the Holy Land. To the Holy Lands. How exciting for those who are going for the first time. Can you remember your first trip to Mecca and Medina? Cast your minds back just for a second and imagine how it was as you were packing your ihram and reading booklets about what to do and what not to do and what to read when you are there and so on. A magical, exciting journey like no other. One lot of people have already left and more will be leaving soon, inshallah. And now that the quota has been increased by 500, people who thought that they were left behind will be excitedly preparing to go. It's all so exciting. Yeah? That's the word, exciting. And there's also excitement in Saudi Arabia to welcome these guests of Allah. Wonderful stuff. Wonderful stuff. But there's also going to be lots of excitement in Saudi Arabia about welcoming other guests to the Holy Land. The guests of Shaitan. Did I just shock you? Well, the story is indeed shocking. You must have heard by now that there's going to be a mega pop concert in the Holy Land. I really hope it's not true. I really hope it's fake news. But it appears to be true. Let me read to you from the British Guardian newspaper as reported by the Associated Press. It says here, but wait, hang on. I'm going to read it exactly as it is, so sensitive listeners should switch off for a minute or so because the words may seem a bit crude, but they have to be said to clearly illustrate the absurdity of the situation. And the headline says, Nicki Minaj to headline music festival in Saudi Arabia. Nicki Minaj will perform in Saudi Arabia. It was announced on Wednesday last week as the ultra-conservative kingdom sheds decades of restrictions on entertainment. The female rapper is known for her outlandish, provocative style and hits like Anaconda, where she raps about her big fat backside. Her lyrics are often laced with profanities, that means swear words, and her skin-bearing music videos often include twerking, which I won't explain to you. Christian groups criticized her 2012 Grammy Awards performance, which included dancing priests and exorcism. Saudi organizers announced she would be the headline act at the Jeddah World Fest on 18 July. The concert, which in line with Saudi laws is alcohol and drug-free, is open to people aged 16 and older and will take place at the King Abdullah Sports Stadium in the Red Sea City. Reactions on social media range from shock and joy to criticism and disappointment. In a profanity-laced video post on Twitter and viewed more than 37,000 times, a Saudi woman wearing a headscarf accused the Saudi government of hypocrisy for inviting Minaj to perform, but requiring women who attend the concert to wear the modest full-length robe known as the abaya. Most Saudi women also veil their hair and faces. The Saudi woman says she is going to go and shake her ass and all her songs are indecent and about sex and shaking ass, and then you tell me to wear the abaya? What the hell? Saudi organizers said the concert will be broadcast globally and covered by MTV. Other performers include the British artist Liam Payne, Liam Payne, and American DJ Steve Aoki. The kingdom is also promising quick electronic visas for international visitors who want to attend. I don't know how long the Hajj visa takes, but now they're going to make special provision, quick electronic visas, perhaps online. The article says, over the past several months, the kingdom has seen performances by Mariah Carey and Iglesias. I thought I had the name wrong. The Black Eyed Peas, Sean Paul, and DJs David Guetta and Tiesto. That's despite the widespread international backlash since October over the killing of the Saudi critic and writer Jamal Khashoggi by Saudi agents close to the crown prince in the kingdom's consulate in Turkey. Such concerts are a stark change from when Saudi morality police would raid establishments that played loud music. Gender segregation between single men and women is still enforced in many restaurants, coffee shops, public schools and universities. But other rules have been loosened, with women now allowed to drive and attend events in sports stadiums. There you are. So, on the one side of the Holy Land, we have the Hajj, and on the other side, we have Nicki Minaj. So there you are, folks. Mohammed bin Salman wants to turn Saudi Arabia, or should I call it Sordid Arabia, Sordid Arabia, into Dubai, or maybe down the line into Las Vegas. May Allah help us all. And you know, there's something that I always wonder about. Why is it that when there's a large-scale attack on Muslims in different parts of the world, the fiery statements are issued by Muslim organizations? When this happens, fiery statements are issued, and we see huge marches and so on. But this pop concert travesty is a massive assault on Islam right there in the Holy Land. And our leadership is somewhat muted, a bit quiet. Why are there no marches and other actions to demonstrate our outrage about this travesty? I'm waiting. And to another story that is making the headlines in that region. Shame, man. I feel sorry for the ruler of Dubai, Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum. His fro, Prince Haya bin Al Hussein, she comes from the royal family in Jordan. She ran away to London. Let me read to you the latest on about this from the British Daily Mail newspaper. The latest. And it says here, Dubai's ruler suspected his estranged wife, Princess Haya, had inappropriate contact with a British bodyguard when he found them together during a surprise visit to their London home, a friend has claimed. Sheikh Mohammed Al Maktoum returned unexpectedly to the 85 million pound mansion from attending a joint wedding of their three sons in Dubai in May. So the mansion in London is 85 million. Family sources said he was shocked to find his 45-year-old wife with the bodyguard at the lavish residence and immediately demanded that she return with him to Dubai. Princess Haya refused and is now set to be involved in the UK's most expensive divorce. The billionaire racehorse owner was already concerned about the close relationship between his much younger wife and the former army officer who provided security for the Dubai royal family, it is claimed. Princess Haya, one of his six wives, lavished gifts on the bodyguard while senior royals were critical of the closeness between the pair. According to the Mail Online, the Sheikh came back to the house unannounced and found his wife with the bodyguard. His suspicions were confirmed. Having left his son's wedding, he was not expected to be back so early. he did not tell the staff he would be coming back and arrived unannounced at the house where he found his wife and the bodyguard. They were too close for his liking. However, reports in the Times newspaper indicate that the Sheikh's suspicions were in fact unfounded. The billionaire Sheikh flew home to Dubai while his wife and the two young children remained in London. He later posted a poem to social media that indicated that alluded to the alleged close relationship. He wrote, "You betrayer, you betrayed the most precious trust, and your game has been revealed." That's his poem. The Sheikh had left his wife alone with the bodyguard to attend his eldest son, Prince Hamdan's wedding on May 15th. Two other sons, Sheikh Maktoum, deputy ruler of Dubai, and Sheikh Ahmad, were also wed at the same time. Haya, Princess Haya, one of the Sheikh's six wives, has a court date later this month that is said to be the most expensive divorce, with the pair hiring top lawyers. She has engaged Fiona Shackleton, who handled the divorce of Princess Diana from Prince Charles. The Sheikh and his estranged wife are also battling each other for custody of the children. Sources said the senior members of the royal court had become concerned with the inappropriate intimacy between the princess and the unnamed bodyguard. Right, let me just skip down a little bit. The company, it says here, it was claimed on Wednesday that Princess Haya ran away from a luxurious life in Dubai, having spent months meticulously plotting her escape because of what she learned about another member of the Dubai royal who tried to flee. Princess Latifa, a daughter of the billionaire racehorse-owning Sheikh, by another of his six wives, was said to have been captured as she tried to get away to make a new life and dragged back to Dubai. Right, so Princess Haya and her husband are friends of the Queen, prompting fears she may be dragged into what could be Britain's biggest ever divorce. So there you are, folks. Shocking stuff. But you know what shocked me? The guy lives, or his mansion in London is worth £85 million. That, dear listeners, in rands is 1,509,009,362 rands and 20 cents. Good heavens, eh? Did you get that? Hey, let me say that once more. In rands, that is 1,509,009,362 rands and 20 cents. Isn't it wonderful? So much wealth. Yet I'm sure he doesn't have a peaceful sleep in his expensive bed. And of course, he supports the Saudi-led destruction of Yemen, where people have nothing at all. What a world we are living in, eh? Madness everywhere. And speaking about madness, let me tell you more about that subject after this break. Welcome back. The program is called The Big Picture. And as I was telling you, there's all kinds of madness all over this world. And let's cross over the ocean to the good old U.S. of A. The good old U.S. of A. And President Pagla. In July 2017, Donald went to France. It was Bastille Day in France, a very important day where there is a huge military parade every year. It's quite spectacular. Donald was, of course, the guest of Emmanuel Macron. Pagla was very impressed by this huge military display, this parade, with soldiers and tanks passing by and marching bands and jets flying overhead. So he went back home and announced that he wants to do the same in America on the 4th of July, which is also a big holiday in the United States. And so, on the 4th of July, it happened. This is what ABC News reported. Donald Trump hoped for a parade to rival Bastille Day. Instead, he got small crowds and soggy tanks. The heavy rain that fell on his 4th of July event made the tanks look a little sad. By the president's own metrics, crowd size and TV ratings, the show fell short of expectations also. Only one network took the speech live, and the crowd size was measured in thousands rather than hundreds of thousands promised by Mr. Trump. Right? Okay, here's another bit. In his speech, he made a speech there, of course, and this is what he said. This is an article from the newspaper. It says, during his tribute to the army, Trump said, in June of 1775, the Continental Congress created a unified army out of the revolutionary forces encamped around Boston and New York. Our army manned the air. It ran the ramparts. It took over the airports. It did everything it had to do. And at Fort McHenry, under the rockets' red glare, it had nothing but victory. Now, people who were listening were quick to point out that in 1775, air travel did not occur in the U.S. until early in the 1900s. There were no planes in 1775, but Pagla says that the army took over the airports. Now, as I always say, how did it happen that America, with more than 300 million people, could elect such a clown to the highest office? The most powerful man in the world, we are told. Shocking. Well, I suppose that is what democracy brings, eh? And he runs the White House like a corner cafe. He brought his family in to advise him. His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is heading the Palestine-Israel peace process. He had a big conference in Bahrain to get the Arabs to contribute a huge amount of money to bribe the Palestinians to forget about getting their own state, but just have a better life. It was a big flop. And his daughter goes everywhere with him. She is regarded as his senior advisor. Can you believe it? Senior advisor. In the British newspaper, The Express quoted a senior Indian diplomat as saying this: we regard Ivanka Trump the way we do half-wit Saudi princes. It's in our national interest to flatter them. Did you get that? When diplomats, of course these are highly intelligent people, when they meet stupid Saudi princes, they speak nicely to them, pretend that what they are saying is so interesting, just to flatter them, because these princes are rich and powerful. So these diplomats need them. Let me read that again. We regard Ivanka Trump the way we do half-wits Saudi princes. It is in our national interest to flatter them. I can just imagine how important these princes feel when they are flattered by these diplomats. If only they could read the minds of these diplomats, it would be something like this. Hey, you moron, you're speaking absolute garbage, but I have to act interested because we need you to invest in our country. So that's what they also think of Ivanka Trump, Donald's chief advisor. Phew, she must be feeling so good that these diplomats give us so much of respect and listen to her as if gems of wisdom are coming out of her mouth. Right, we're going to shift gears a little bit, and we're going to cross over now to our guest. And our guest is, of course, someone well known to you, and that is Shannon Ibrahim, who is the group foreign editor of the Independent Media. Shannon Ibrahim, welcome to The Big Picture.
Hello?
I think we're having some... Shannon Ibrahim, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to The Big Picture program.
Thank you.
And thanks once again for making the time to speak to us.
You're welcome, AB.
Now, people are worried about the direction that the United States has been taking in recent times in dealing with global issues. How do you see it?
Well, the U.S. has reverted, it seems, to a long-gone era dating back to the 1930s in the time of the recession. And at that time, it had been determined to pull up the drawbridges and isolate itself from the world. But the biggest difference between then and now, I would say, is that the U.S. isolation at that time was premised on the U.S. not getting hurt by becoming entangled in global politics or foreign conflicts, so that it was more defensive. But what they're doing now seems to be born out of arrogance and selfishness. Basically, Trump seems to be saying that the rest of the world can go to hell as long as America gets what it wants. And that actually was the modus operandi of the Trump business empire for many decades. And now it seems to be the way that Trump is running the country. And I almost feel sometimes that former President Barack Obama is now beginning to seem like he had been a light on a hilltop, if you consider the fact that he had been trying to atone at the end of his presidency for his country's past sins. For example, he was trying to reverse the isolation of Cuba. He was apologizing for dropping nuclear bombs on Hiroshima, his country, for the U.S. having done that in the Second World War. He was attempting to make amends for the U.S. role in the Vietnam War by going to Vietnam. And his Secretary of State, John Kerry, had been working around the clock for months to ensure a sound nuclear deal with Iran, even caring about the kidnapped girls in the far-flung reaches of Nigeria. So if you contrast what he was doing with what Trump is doing now, it's really quite stark.
So how different is Trump's approach?
Well, Trump seems to be determined to unravel all those foreign policy legacies. He's tried to kill the Iran nuclear deal. He's also forcing others to do so as well. And the irony of targeting a country like Iran, which has never once in its history attacked another country, is quite incredible. And for Trump, Cuba must continue to be denied the most basic medicines and essential goods, as well as the right to trade freely with the rest of the world, and for no good reason at all. And so the colonial message that Trump seems to be sending to a poor, desperately poor nation like Cuba is starve or submit. And that's something that Cuba has proven over the past 60 years it will never do. But Cuba has also proven that even in poverty, you can afford to provide your people with free social services, excellent free health care. And Trump has also, by the way, taken a wrecking ball to Obama's attempts, as we know, at universal health care and refused to replace it with a viable alternative.
Shannon, Trump seemed a lonely figure at the recent G20 summit.
Well, he was a lonely figure in that everyone was against his policies. I mean, he obviously embraced all the world leaders and tried to play the big statesman, but in terms of policy, he was certainly a lonely figure. At this year's G20 in Osaka, Trump really seemed to almost be a black sheep in terms of his policies and economic policies. So one by one, world leaders stood up and criticized the protectionist measures, particularly of the U.S. President Xi Jinping of China was the most robust in his remarks, saying that protectionism is destroying the global trade order. President Moon Jae-in of South Korea echoed those sentiments, and he called for a return to free trade. And then you had Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who was the host of the G20, saying that only free and open economies are the foundation for peace and prosperity. And then Russian President Vladimir Putin had argued that increasing protectionism is actually the result of politically motivated restrictions. And then we even had Trump's close ally, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, warning of the dangers of one-sided decisions, which probably didn't go very well with Trump. But it is interesting because the pressure exerted on Trump by Putin, Modi, and the EU president, Jean-Claude Juncker, the pressure for him to settle his trade differences with China was so strong that Trump had little choice but to back down on his threat to impose additional tariffs on another $300 billion worth of Chinese goods. And that's a relief to all of us and to the global economy, because such a move would have resulted in serious countermeasures, potentially driving the world economy into a recession and curbing the path to global prosperity.
Now, Trump is also out of step with the rest of the world on many other issues.
Well, perhaps the most egregious display of Trump's selfishness has been his utter refusal, once again, to affirm the Paris Climate Change Agreement. So all the leaders at the G20 reaffirmed that, of course, except for Trump, and that was the same as what happened last year in Buenos Aires. But we know that the U.S. is the second biggest polluter of greenhouse gas emissions. And if it continues in this way, it will ultimately destroy the planet as we know it. All the world leaders seem to accept the scientific evidence that devastating hurricanes and heat waves like we saw recently in France, are all being caused by the rise in global temperatures. And that's why they've committed their countries to try to limit the rise in global temperatures to under 1.5 degrees Celsius. But there you have Trump playing to his base, claiming that cutting emissions would cost American jobs. But I also think his own ignorance does play a part, because he claims that climate change is not man-made. And he cites the fact that there are parts of the United States that are extra cold in winter, which leads him to conclude, if you can believe it, that climate change just cannot be happening. But anyway, be that as it may, I think the world will move on without Trump. And we saw that in the trilateral meeting held on Saturday last week between the UN, China, and France, which all agreed that they were going to move climate change and efforts to address it forward. And really, Trump will continue to be obstinate, but his obstinance will actually continue to plunge his country and the world into greater levels of suffering. And that's because his country will continue this burgeoning pollution, but his country also has such a sizable economy that it has the potential to cause serious economic pain to the rest of the world.
Well, there you are, folks. Excellent stuff there from Shannon Ibrahim, who is the group foreign editor of the Independent Media. Shannon, it was a pleasure having you on The Big Picture, and hope to speak to you soon once again.
Thanks, AB. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
And bye-bye.
Bye.
Right, we have about 10 or 12 minutes left. And in the program now, we have another guest, and that is the effervescent, the lawyer, the activist, Aslam Mayat in the studio. And Aslam, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam to the listeners.
You have just come in from a conference. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Look, before I answer, let me just say that the Proteas are playing today and Bafana tonight. Bafana's playing Mo Salah and the Pharaohs, and we wish them all well. Yeah, look, the MPL saga has dogged us for many years. And although MPL was supported by UKSA, which is the mother body of the Jamaiyats of all the provinces, and the Sunni Jamaiyat, there was significant opposition, as everyone knows. The court gave Parliament 2 years to pass legislation recognizing Muslim marriages. This decision has been appealed. In the meantime, the Law Commission has invited comment on a proposed Single Marriage Act to recognize all faith and non-faith unions as marriages. So that will include life partnership, same-sex marriages, whatever. Now, all the parties agree that non-recognition of nikahs causes hardship, particularly to wives and children who are the most vulnerable. The Association of Muslim Lawyers and Accountants felt that the time was right to act as a facilitator to get the ulama to reach consensus. And that resulted in a groundbreaking meeting which was held at Al Baraka Bank in June with all the major players, both for and against. And for the first time, the protagonists had an open and healthy exchange. Each party obtained a better understanding and appreciation of the other's viewpoint. Now, as at the moment, there's no draft bill out, so, you know, as we all know, the shaitan is in the detail. So it's a bit early to anticipate the attitude of the various parties to a Single Marriage Act. I think there's this healthy exchange. The parties are talking to each other, so it's very healthy move that's taken place. And Amal has also had meetings with individual ulama bodies and stakeholders on the single marriage legislation. And this morning, we reported back to our members.
Well, Aslam, Jazakallah khair for giving us some insight into what's happening on that particular issue. And as We all know it's an ongoing debate, and we will call on you once again, inshallah, to give us updates as you get them. All right, so let's then move on to something else completely different. And the question is, did God give greater Israel to the Jews?
Yeah, look, in order to explain, I'm going to give you the Old Testament Hebrew version, which differs from the Islamic version. In Islam, Allah Almighty does not have favorite or chosen races and families, except in piety. In his final sermon, the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "All mankind is from Adam and Eve. An Arab has no superiority over a non-Arab, nor does a non-Arab have any superiority over an Arab. A white has no superiority over a black, nor does a black have any superiority over a white. None have superiority over another except by piety and good action." Now, if you look at Genesis 12:7, the Lord appeared to Abraham and said, "To your offspring or seed I will give this land." So as I said, I'm giving you the biblical Hebrew version.
Yes.
Prophet Abraham had his first son, Ishmael, through the black slave girl, Hagar. And his second son, Isaac, through his first wife, Sarah. Now, logically, offspring means all his children. But Jews have decided that God promised the land to the descendants of Isaac and his son Jacob only. Hence, unlike others, the bloodline and Jewish ancestry goes through the mother and not the father. But to suit the agenda even further, every convert, regardless of ancestry, becomes a child of Abraham, but through Sarah.
Right, I think you've clarified that. But, you know, Aslam, many Jews are not even Semitic, but European converts.
Yeah. Look, you've got the Mizrahi Jews. Those are the ones who remained in the Middle East. Then you've got the Sephardic Jews. They're from Spain. Now, that Spain, you know, is closer to the Middle East and East Africa. Top of the heap are the Ashkenazis, who come from Europe and have greater European ancestry and features. Now, Rav Drachman said that Ashkenazis, should not be buried in Sephardic cemeteries, because he said that the immigration from Russia had brought a high percentage of non-Jews to Israel. And if one gets married in an Ashkenazic cemetery, buried in an Ashkenazic cemetery, he is at reasonable risk of being buried next to a non-Jew, which is no good. So the argument is that the Sephardic Jews are more pure and untainted in their Jewishness. Now, unlike the Palestinians, many of the Jews are not Semites. And there's many of these European Jews, especially from Eastern Europe, are right-wing fascists and racists.
Right, I think we're going to leave the discussion there, because there are many issues concerning Israel that we're going to be covering, and other issues also, with the lawyer and activist Aslam Mayet. And it's, of course, the discussion is going to carry on after 12 o'clock on Radio Al Ansar. We'll be leaving Radio Islam at 12 o'clock. So it's that time again when we have to go to the big picture graveyard, where I'm going to dig up some old jokes. Now, don't get fed up because you've already heard them. Just pretend that you never heard them before and laugh out loudly. Right. Are you ready? Okay. So, Bala is a big gangster from Phoenix. His nickname was Rottweiler. Bala the Rottweiler. But people couldn't pronounce that properly. So, slowly it changed to Bala the Rottifella. Anyway, People were very afraid of Bala. He didn't waste time. You just make him cross, he'll kill you. So Bala robbed a bank in Stanger. He took the millions and gave it to his bookkeeper, Samson, to stash it away. Samson, from the time that he was born, could not speak or hear. He was a deaf mute. I think that's the politically correct term to describe a deaf mute. Anyway, Samson could, of course, communicate using sign language. Samson refused to tell Bala where the money was hidden. So Bala was very angry and he took his friend Prega and went to Samson's house. Prega could speak in sign language. Bala said to Prega, "Ask him, where is the money?" And Prega used sign language to ask Samson. Samson, using sign language, of course, answered, "I will not tell you." Prega explains to Bala what Samson said. And Bala is very cross. He takes out a big gun and he puts it against Samson's head. Bala says, "Tell him, if he does not tell me where the money is hidden, I will blow his brains out." Prega uses sign language to communicate Bala's message to Samson. Samson is so scared that he uses sign language to tell Prega, "Go to the Chatsworth Cemetery in Unit 7 and at the back gate on the left-hand side there is a guava tree. The money is buried in front of the tree." Bala is impatient and asks Prega, "What is he saying?" And Prega replies, "He says, you haven't got the guts to pull the trigger." This is A.B. Dawji bidding you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.